Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
Well, I'm good, except, you know, this show isn't really happening when you're hearing it.
We are working ahead, as they say.
We are.
Filling in the pages in the workbook a couple of days in advance.
Our show was pre-recorded this week because we wanted to have a Thanksgiving holiday. So while we have great guests, we are not going to have any fresh news because we don't know the news yet.
True. It hasn't been made by the time we've done this.
Well, at least we didn't think so. You'd have to live your life a little differently. Well, we hope you had a great holiday, didn't eat too much, and were able to maybe get out and get a ride in. Our show this week focuses on three East Coast people. Drew Goldalian lives in Wissahickon, Pennsylvania. And to those who know about his handmade frames, he's the force behind Engine Cycles. Unlike many of the custom builders we've spoken with over the past couple of years, Drew also owns Wissahickon Cycles, which is a retail store. And he keeps it completely separate from his custom business. It's a very unique business model. I was interested in it when I heard him give a presentation at NABS a couple of years ago. So I'm really glad I'm getting a chance to talk with him directly. And he'll be with us a little bit later in the show. First up, Mary McConnellog and her husband and racing partner, Mike Broderick, are going to talk to us from the Cape on the East Coast in a place called Chilmark, Massachusetts. Mike and Mary form an elite professional two-person mountain bike team with a trophy case full of awards and medals. They've been racing together since they met at a race 13 years ago. Mary is a two-time Olympian and holds numerous records, including world championships. Mike has stood on podiums around the world. We're going to get ready to talk with them right now. And then right after that, we're going to talk for a moment with Tim Blumenthal, who's with Bikes Belong. They have introduced a new war room, they're calling it, the BOEM Strategy Center. And I think it's an interesting, in light of the fact that we just had elections, it's an interesting idea as we move forward trying to get some transportation initiatives for bicycling, that this war room is going to be put into operation first of the year. So without further ado, let's talk with Mary McConnellog and her husband, Mike Broderick. Thanks for joining us on The Outspoken Cyclist this evening.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So let's get a little bit of background on each of you. And I'm going to start with Mary because, of course, you're the girl, I'm the girl. So we're going to start with that. So I know you're originally from California. Tell us about where you grew up and what you were doing before you got into bike racing.
Well, I was born and raised in Fairfax, California, but when I got into bike racing, I was living in Bend, Oregon at the time, and just before that, I was living in Seattle, working as a waitress, riding my bike for fun on the weekends, and sort of looking for that new extra something in my life.
I guess you found it, huh?
Yes.
Yes. And Mike, what about you?
Well, I'm from Massachusetts, and I always knew that I wanted to do something involved with sports and individual sports, and I kind of went through the whole routine of, organized sports with school and then outdoor sports, including surfing and, running and biking, and biking just kind of took over as the main passion eventually as it worked out.
So you didn't surf in Boston, I don't care what you say. So you must have gone out to the West Coast at some point.
Yeah, that's actually where I spent a lot of time on the West Coast and basically surfing wherever I could. So sort of a side passion, and definitely need to be somewhere other than Massachusetts to really get
right. We don't often see a husband-wife racing team in our sport, especially off-road. Are there other two-person married teams like yours?
We're pretty unique the way that we have such a hands-on approach to our team and that we both race. There are other husband-wife teams, well, racers, that both participate in cross-country mountain biking. But what we do is pretty unique, and we hope to inspire more people to do it, because it's a wonderful thing to be able to share something like this so intensely, and you know, with patience and respect, it can work.
So when you say it's unique, what is unique about your particular style of racing or the way you run your team? And the team is just the two of you, right?
Our program is unique in that we have built up our entire team program and run our team completely on our own. So over the years, we've developed some amazing relationships with companies who are interested to have us represent. So we've nurtured these relationships over the past over a decade for some companies. And the fact that Mike is wrenching on the bikes the night before he races the World Cup and in my feed zone oftentimes before his race, supporting me. Self-support and doing it on our own without a manager or a director or anyone else calling the shots but us is sort of our unique approach.
So when you guys get on the road and travel, what's your vehicle like?
Well, we actually have a lot of different vehicles in a lot of different places. We like to say we're collecting wheel estate all across the country, and indeed outside the country. So usually the stock ride is like a vehicle that can tow a live-in trailer, and so we have like the freedom to have a car and a place to stay, and we sort of stockpile these sort of launch pads around the East and West Coast, so we're free to kind of fly to a certain location, pick up our vehicle, and hit the local races that are in the area.
What a cool idea. I have never heard of that. That is such a great idea. And because it's only the two of you, you don't have to worry about 10 vehicles like that in one place.
That's right. It's pretty simple and basic. And the way we found out that we needed to have a rolling kitchen or a rolling bedroom or a rolling shop was when we were going to try to make the Olympic team in 2004. So I was just wondering how I was going to be able to eat well living over in Europe and be in control of my diet, our diet. And so I Google searched RV rental Germany and came up with this great company outside of Munich. And we've been going back and forth racing in Europe comfortably in an RV that we rent from our buddy. So it's actually a really convenient way to travel so that we can take care of our basic needs of, you know, special foods and regular sleep, etc.
Okay, you said it, special foods. Tell us about your diet, because I'm always interested in diet.
Well, diet's something that, you know, as our bodies change and as we become aware of more ideas out there about how to best fuel our own body, because everybody's different, we pretty much stick to like a real foods diet where we eat a lot of, you know, good food with like sweet potatoes and rice and chicken and fish, you know where our meat comes from. We try and eat organic as much as possible. However, traveling to certain parts of the world, there's no such thing as organic
right.
in certain countries. And you just try and eat as natural and close to the earth as you can.
So you do cook for yourselves then for the most part?
Oh, I spend hours in the kitchen every day. Yes, it's a big part of what we do is making sure we have nourishing foods.
So let's talk a little bit about the actual type of racing you do, because you're not a Peloton racer. You two are basically mountain bike racers, cross country. Yes.
Yes, we're actually pretty much involved in the full gamut of off road racing. So we're certainly primarily a mountain bike racing team. We've been racing cyclocross right alongside that for years, and I guess I won't get into what that is, but it's a slightly different sport, as well as mountain bike stage racing. And there's also several other shorter events, light gravity events, a thing called the Eliminator, which is like or a short track event. So there's a lot of diversity in the type of racing we do. Most of it does happen to be primarily off-road and not your typical road racing. We really don't do much racing on the road. We train on the road quite a bit, but pretty much do all our competition in the dirt. Yeah.
The bikes that you ride, and I know you ride at least one titanium bike. How many bikes? Let me ask you this. How many bikes do you have?
Well,
I hear you back there laughing.
Yeah. We've been paid to race our bikes, and we get to keep our bike frames. So over the past years, we've gotten one bike every year. And we don't throw these bikes away. We don't sell these bikes. They don't break. They're unbelievable works of art. So we're collecting bikes, we could say.
So is it going to be the Mike and Mary Bike Museum at some point?
Well, I don't know about a museum. I think they'd be more like the Mike and Mary Roller Derby Arena or something like that.
Ooh, that's a good idea.
With all the bikes, because I like to keep them all running good and, you know, ride them all. So it's like a museum wouldn't quite cover it, you know. I think the racetrack, maybe.
I have a question about controversy in cycling. You obviously have been able to avoid that. Are you tested as mountain bike racers professionally?
Yes. In fact, just yesterday, USADA came and wanted to test my pee. It
okay.
happens at any time, any day, any place. We have to register with the Anti-Doping Federation of the United States and tell them where we are every single day so that they can come unannounced to test us. Also tested occasionally competition. So it's a good thing what USADA's doing, you know, trying to keep the field clean. And it's really just disturbing what's gone on for so many years, obviously, that we're now finding out. So, it's disappointing, but I'm glad they come and test us.
Well, let's talk about your success for a moment. I mean, both of you have stood on podiums for years and years and years now. Mary, you've been to the Olympics twice. Haven't you guys won a race together?
Yes.
Some stage race that you do together?
Yes. One of our favorite stage races that we've been doing for the past 3 years is called the Trans Andes Challenge.
Right.
And this is a stage race that Mike and I compete as a mixed team. So we must stay together at all times and throughout this 6-day race.
And obviously it says Trans Andes. So that tells us where it is. How high up in the world is that?
Well, they sort of call this Patagonia Light is what they call it. It's really, it's not that high in elevation, but it's actually quite a bit of climbing every day. We're climbing between 6,000 and 7,000 feet a day and over 70 kilometers every day. So
wow.
It's pretty intense and grueling and demanding. And it's not so much the thin air, but it's just the magnitude of the stages that we get to accomplish.
I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Mary McConnellogue and her husband, Mike Broderick, husband and wife racing team. So how do you stay
For sure.
at the top of your game physically? I mean, you race a lot of races every year, and it seems like you try to race and ride year round pretty much.
Well, I think actually that's part of our regimen. The competition really does a lot to keep you sharp. You learn a regimen of racing on the weekends and how to take care of yourself in between races to rise to a higher potential. And if you add a lot of those weekends up, really it does, in our case anyway, add up to living a pretty good life and, you know, actually respecting your body and not just pounding yourself into the ground and breaking yourself down, but, you know, trying to build the body up and maintain a decent level of not being in pain, you know, from all the exercise. So we try to incorporate a lot of positive things in a you know, such as like a yoga class or something like that, or strength routine into our training to balance everything out. So
do you ever take time off?
I sleep well at night, and there's maybe 2 months of the year when we're not racing. That's when we're training and preparing for the season. So I don't know. It's more of a continuous lifestyle and dedication to a way of living that we go.
What kind of advice would you give someone who wants to get to your level as mountain bike racers?
Anyone who wants to get to a professional level in any sport, especially cycling, really just has to live it. It's the passion that's going to bring them there. It's not any strategy. You really have to love what you're doing. It takes a lot of time. It's really a lifestyle more than it is a sport for cycling. And you pretty much need to be all in. And if you're not, you'll know more than any one thing or a number of things you could do. It's just something that has to be a passion.
How about you, Mary? You got anything to add to that?
Well, it's definitely about dedication and hard work and really loving it. A lot of people do ask me, actually, how do you do it? And there really is no one answer, like Mike said. It's about following your intuition and going with the opportunities in front of you and using the resources that are available to you, if you have them, or create them, or have a perspective maybe that you don't need as much as you think you need. It's really, there's no right way to get there or one way to get there. And Mike and I just feel so lucky to have been able to follow our passion, meet the people along the way, and have the inspiration and the health to keep going. And it's really a blessing, and when we're truly grateful.
How many more years do you think you're going to keep this up?
I guess we'll know when we're done, more than, you know, trying to put any real end on it. You know, we're really passionate about the bike, and we know that we're going to want to be involved in, you know, really what's become our community for the rest of our lives. So, you know, the racing part of it is still a huge, huge goal. We have a lot we still want to accomplish. So, you know, I definitely don't want to, like I said, we'll know.
Okay.
In the meantime, have a blast.
What do you do for fun when you're not on the bike?
Oh, there's lots of things we like to do. There's, in fact, too many things that we like to do, but I guess we really love to go to the beach, spend some time either running on the beach or walking or surfing or paddleboarding or just sitting and looking at the water.
That's rare.
That's rare that we're sitting.
Yeah. I sort of got that.
What we do is just enjoy the outdoors and being active. That's fun for us, whether that's running or climbing or
skiing. Or snowboarding or surfing or whatever comes up. We just like to charge.
So we also like music, so that's fun, but we haven't had too much of that in the past few years. That's something we'll have to spend more time doing.
As in playing or attending concerts?
Playing music.
Oh, what do you play?
Mike plays guitar, and he's a great singer, and I studied music in college, so I can play the piano a little bit, and I just love anything musical, and I sing. So that was my vocal performance was my major.
Huh, interesting. Where'd you go to school?
I went to Santa Clara University.
Nice. What are your plans for 2013? What's on the schedule for 2013? You're sort of in between Olympics.
2013 is going to see Mike and I doing much of the same in the past. We're really, you know, excited to keep racing at the highest level, committed to doing the World Cups and Nationals and World Championships if we make the team. Also, to do some stage races. We want to do the Trans-Andes Challenge once again, and also cyclocross. So we've got, you know, just the same path that we're going to keep
full schedule,
walking down,
full schedule
which
ahead.
Is a full schedule, you know, not only just to do it and get the body prepared for it, but to plan it, every single logistic, get the clothing made, get the bikes dialed in. There's a lot to it.
Wow. Sounds like you have full lives.
Yes, that's for sure. My poor mother doesn't hear from me very often. Sorry, Mom.
Well, you'll have to tell her about this interview. At least she'll be able to hear your voice. That's always nice. Well, what are you guys planning to do come holidays? Do you spend the holidays in Massachusetts, or are you going to head out to the West Coast?
Well, actually, we're going to be kind of ignoring the holidays once again.
What do you mean? I'm cooking in turkey.
Well, we'll definitely eat well, I'm sure of that. And we're going to, you know, definitely be together celebrating somewhere. But really, we do so much traveling and have such little time at home. We really, like, pack our time in with our families when we can. Regardless of what time of year it is. And then we'll probably be traveling during the holidays. I think we're going to head down to South America, down to Chile, and start our training for the Trans-Andes down there in the warmer climate. So probably be on the road more or less, but it's not like it's you know, a sad thing, because we're, you know, we have time to catch up with our people around the edges, and you know, we have to get the job done when we can. So,
as I thought it would be, it was a lot of fun to talk to the two of you. I think it's really cool how incredibly involved and immersed in what you're doing. I've sort of peripherally followed you because of our relationship with Seven and your relationship with Seven. So I've sort of known what's been going on, but not to this extent. So it's been a real pleasure to catch up with you and learn about the two of you. And we wish you a lot of luck in the next coming season.
Thank you, Diane. It's been really a pleasure to talk to you too.
Okay. Thanks. Have a great holiday.
Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Mary McConalog and Mike Broderick joined us from Massachusetts. Traveling the world, riding mountain bikes.
The way they're doing it is so cool. So they have like a stash of a travel home and the cooking and the food, you know, and they just go from place to place. They fly in, pick up their little vehicle and go with it. I wonder if they have any pets. I didn't ask them that.
I don't see how you could have animals as pets with a nomadic lifestyle like that.
I guess not. And if they do, they probably leave him at home with his folks.
They have family.
With family.
All right. We're going to take a very short break here.
Okay.
And when we come back, we've got another great guest lined up. Who are we going to talk to, Diane?
We're going to talk with Tim Blumenthal, who's the president of Bikes Belong. He's out in Boulder, Colorado.
All right. We'll be back right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We all share a common journey. We wanted to serve our country and protect the things we love. But for some of us, coming home was more of a challenge than we expected. In the service, we had each other's backs. But as veterans, it can sometimes feel like we're all alone.
For confidential support, call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Chat at veteranscrisisline.net or text 838-255.
We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist.
We are indeed.
And time to talk with someone who's been on the show a few times, and we never tire of getting an update from this gentleman.
No, and I think the what we're going to talk about is very interesting and brand new. So let's welcome Tim Blumenthal from Bikes Belong back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Tim, thanks for joining us again this evening. It's nice to catch up with you.
Always happy to be here.
Well, I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to chat at Interbike, so I wanted to get you back this evening to talk about the new BOEM Strategy Center, or the War Room. First off, can you tell our listeners, what is the BOEM Strategy Center?
Well, you know, more than anything else, it's a place, a physical place and a virtual place where the bike movement tracks and manages and maximizes all of our political assets and opportunities. This is not too technical. It's a strategic repository of all of our assets. And when I say assets, I'm talking mainly about people who can help bicycling.
You're talking everybody from advocacy people at the grassroots all the way through legislators in Washington?
Yeah, and you know, I might order it just the opposite way.
Might
say it starts with members of Congress and their staff members, and you know, by district, by state, it extends to governors and mayors and city council members and business leaders and celebrities and sports stars and CEOs and senior staff members of non-endemic corporations, you know, Fortune 50, 100, 500 corporations. And the one thing that we want to know about all these people is, what do they think about bicycling? Do they ride bikes? Do they have any track record of support connection? And we feel like we can do a pretty good job of tracking all that stuff and then making really good use of it.
So let's back up a second and explain how the name BOEM Strategy Center came about.
Sure. So one of the founders of Bikes Belong is a guy named Leslie BOEM.
Right. And we have interviewed him. We did before he passed away.
And Leslie has been in the bike business for more than 30 years, and a couple years ago he got diagnosed with brain cancer and passed away late this summer.
Right.
And he was one of the founders of Bikes Belong, one of the founders of America Bikes, which is our coalition of all the national bike groups, and just a master strategist and someone who always pushed us to be more politically sophisticated, model ourselves after groups that have been really effective. You know, funny story, Leslie, who is far from a gun advocate or a gun owner, joined the NRA just to find out how the NRA developed its political sophistication. And he'd walk around with his NRA membership card and talk glowingly about, you know, how many people they engaged, how they engaged them, and how effective they were as a political force. And he just said, you know what, bicycling, such a wonderful thing, should aspire to that level of grassroots and national power. So it's named after Leslie. It's called the Bohm Strategy Center. It will physically be located at our headquarters here in Colorado, but it will also be connected to our Washington office and be connected, hopefully, to every one of our partners in the advocacy world. And, you know, I'm talking about not only national groups, but state groups and city groups. And we don't want to share the information with our opponents, but we certainly want to share it with everybody who can benefit from it to help bicycling.
So let's talk a little bit about the information and what it is you're trying to come up with. I know it covers a myriad of programs and data. So let's begin with tracking. What kind of data are you going to try to track and then coordinate it? You know, how will it be reported?
Sure. Well, I want to be careful about this.
Okay.
I'm jumping the gun a little bit. We have hired, and we just announced this, Jen Dice, who is the longtime government relations director for IMBA, the International Mountain Bike Association. In fact, I hired her to come work at IMBA back in 2001. And for your listeners who don't know, we're actually located in the same office building, not in the same offices, but in the same building. I left IMBA 8 years ago. Bikes Belong has been a big financial and practical supporter and partner of IMBA. And anyway, Jen, after 11 years, was so excited about this opportunity that she's going to come across to be our vice president of government relations and run the war room, the Bohm Strategy Center. And I promised her one thing that helped convince her to take the job. I said, Jen, I'm not going to have a fully baked, complete plan with staff and everything in place. When you start in late January, I'm going to leave that up to you so that you have the freedom to use your experience and expertise to shape it the way that you want to shape it. So that's my disclaimer. Okay.
Okay.
But some things are pretty clear. One of the things that we need to do a better job of is getting elected officials and leaders to show up at major bike events. And, you know, I'm just going to reveal to you that, like, one of the things we talked about a lot during the last transportation bill process was how do we get members of Congress to come out to a ribbon cutting and realize how great the federal investment in bike infrastructure has been and see all the happy people and hear from mayors and city council members and local business owners, bike store owners, how it's helped with to increase business and, you know, all the other benefits that we talk about. We've had a hard time doing that. So one of our goals is to do a better job of developing a schedule of major bike events and then actually working to get the right people there to interact with bicycling supporters and to more fully appreciate what those investments, the federal investments, have done.
Okay, so events are one of the things. What else?
Yeah. Well, you know, media coverage is so important.
Yes,
and you know, I don't know about you, but one of the first things that I do every morning is I read everything I can that's been written about bicycling and published overnight. So, you know, it's just a simple Google search, and I have a lot of keywords, and I get an automatic digest. So anything about federal transportation, anything about bicycling, anything about bicycling in cities, bike sharing, bikes belong. I read, and that helps us stay on top of trends. And so we're going to track media coverage of bicycling and expand our list of journalists, you know, who are simply interested or have a track record, or even better, some are quite positive and sympathetic would be an understatement about they get the value of bicycling and they want to write about it. So that's another important thing. Another will be I'm not a big reader of, say, Us magazine or People magazine, but there it seems like every day I see photographs of, oh, it might be Tom Cruise and his kids riding bikes in New York City.
Right.
Or, you know, or
sure.
Liev Schreiber or Ellen Page or Justin Timberlake and Jessica Biel. And, you know, I don't want to sound too superficial or cavalier about it, but it is possible and probably likely that all of these celebrities love riding bikes, love the freedom of it, love everything about it that we love, and might be willing to do a fundraiser or lend their name or add mainstream credibility in a way that would help us. So that's another thing.
And that's interesting. That's a great thing.
I think it's really, really great. And, you know, one thing that is super important is government staffers are so important. And as it turns out, because a lot of government congressional staffers, governor staffers, mayor staffers are young, and even the ones who aren't young, they all tend to, not all, but a lot of them tend to really like bicycling and to be really sympathetic. And as you know and I know, a lot of policy, a lot of legislation is actually written and developed by these staffers.
Right.
You know, it's just not possible for the actual member of Congress or the governor or the mayor to get down into the weeds on every issue, write the legislation. It's presented to them in nearly finished form. So the more we know who's there in the trenches doing that work, who likes bicycling and has a track record of bicycling, that will help us too. So, you know, it goes on and on. Messaging, developing and testing messaging is going to be part of what we're going to do. But I want you to picture sort of a multimedia room with, you know, a live video screen connected to our D.C. government relations office.
Sure.
Where they're talking in real time. You know, this is the war room idea, and it's not my favorite phrase. But
no, me neither. I was trying to think of something different before I called you today, but
it's
okay.
We've got one. It's called the Bohm Strategy Center.
Well, that's true, but that's a lot of words, you know, if you're trying to quickly say, okay, call the center. Maybe it's just the center.
Yeah, well, hopefully it'll be so successful and well done. But, yeah, you know, part of it, we're going to use some pretty sophisticated databases, and we've invested. One of the things that Bikes Belong did 4 years ago was we adopted the Blue State Digital communications platform that helped President Obama win in 2008. Right after the election, we called up Blue State Digital and we said, hey, we run a nonprofit national bike group and we want to mobilize people and get them to write emails and letters to their members of Congress. And we just want to have a better way of identifying them and connecting with them. And Blue State Digital said, well, everybody and their brother is after us because we're successful, but we love bicycling, so we'll do it. So
cool.
The short story there is that we've got this pretty robust technology, Blue State Digital, that will help us make the most of the war room.
So let me ask a question about how Bikes Belong, the war room, and this project dovetails with the bike summit and actual lobbying. Will there be some sort of lobbying arm that comes out of this, something that actually is policy making or at least, you know, trying to move policy in the right direction?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when Bikes Belong formed in 1999, our one and primary goal was to maximize the federal investment in bike infrastructure and to promote pro-bike policy. And nothing has changed. the war room, the BOEM Strategy Center, is simply a tool to make that effort more effective. And ideally, it will be totally linked and connected to the National Bike Summit and to, you know, the League of American Bicyclists and the Alliance for Biking and Walking and, you know, Adventure Cycling and Rails to Trails. And,
okay, I
you know,
see.
Everybody. And,
sure.
Ideally, the resources and the conclusions and the strategy of the war room will be key in shaping our lobbying and government relations. If anything, all of that has become more important. But let me say one more thing really quickly about it, if it's all right.
And of course.
That is that, you know, there are 535 members of Congress, and there's just no way, even though we've grown and, you know, on a good day, I think we have a lot of capability, we cannot effectively track and manage 535 congressional relationships, but we can manage 20 of the key relationships.
Right.
You know, maybe 12 on the House side and 8 on the Senate side. And I don't want to go too deep politically, but I'm just saying that if we really focus on a few members of Congress and a few governors and a few mayors and, you know, a few senators, few U.S. representatives, I think we can do a good job. So we have to be selective and strategic, and that's what the center is going to help us to do.
Yeah, you want the influential people who are talking our programs, our, you know, talk our talk.
That, and also the ones who are doing the opposite.
Oh, interesting.
You know, the ones, and I would just say that, you know, I'm not going to identify anybody by name unless you really, really push me. But, I mean, there are members of Congress who really think that the investment in bicycling only benefits people who ride bikes.
Yes, and, I know that, of course.
Yeah, and what we know, and we're getting better at telling the story, is that that investment benefits everyone. And I think Secretary Ray LaHood, Secretary of Transportation, has done a beautiful job in his blog. I think he's been on your show, right?
Yeah, he has. Oh, yeah. I read Fast Lane all the time. He's absolutely in that corner. In fact, we just lost one who originally started out not in our corner. Stephen La Tourette decided to retire. He did not run for office again, and he was in our corner. It was very disappointing.
Yeah, and he's been great. And I was the one who, you know, he made some critical remarks that were misinterpreted. And I was the one who had to go to his office to talk with him. And I found him to be very reasonable, very smart, and he's been a really solid supporter. The one thing that I've heard, I read today, and, you know, it's uncertain how long Ray LaHood will stay on as Secretary of Transportation. I've heard Stephen La Tourette's name mentioned as a possible Secretary of Transportation should LaHood leave.
That's interesting because he has a background in the railroad, number one.
Yeah.
And he did say on CBS this morning, CBS Sunday morning, that he's looking for a job with CBS Hiring.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he's great.
He is great.
And the thing that was so exciting about La Tourette is watching the transformation. And I think, you know, back to my point about LaHood, what LaHood said is even if you'll never ride a bike in your entire life, you will benefit from the federal investment to make bicycling safer and easier because if you're driving and somebody else has left their car at home, there'll be one less car on the road. If you're driving and you're looking for a parking spot and more people are riding bikes, you have a better shot at getting that parking spot. And if a lot of people are riding bikes, fewer parking spots are going to need to be built, and those are expensive to build. So the hood's very sophisticated, and, you know, it's really been a great thing. But we're going to work on that messaging.
I'm excited. I assume the war room comes online in January, I think you said. You wanted to get it up and running before the new Congress convenes?
Yeah, right as the new Congress convenes.
Okay.
We're such good partners with IMBA that it's very important that Gendyce finish up there neatly.
Sure.
And, you know, it's going to be, this new Congress is going to be really, really fascinating, you know, for all the reasons that I'm sure you know.
But, I do.
We've got to be ready, so I'm excited about it.
Well, I wish you a lot of luck, Jen a lot of luck. Eventually I'll catch up with her. I'm going to let her get some breathing room in and see how she's doing maybe in March or April after
Great.
The summit. And I appreciate you taking time telling me about the BOEM Strategy Center at Bikes Belong, Tim.
Always a pleasure. I hope it was something that you and your listeners can understand, and feel free to check back.
I will indeed. Have a great night.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Tim. Bye-bye.
Tim Blumenthal of Bikes Belong joined us from Boulder, Colorado,
where Bikes Belong is headquartered, and the new BOEM Strategy Center. I'm pretty excited about it. I think it's really cool. I'm anxious to talk to Jen Dice as soon as she, you know, finishes up her work with IMBA and then comes on board with Bikes Belong. So we'll catch up with her and find out how her strategy's going.
All right, we're going to come back and bring you one final interview on this Thanksgiving edition of The Outspoken Cyclist right after this.
Would your business survive a disaster? Nearly two-thirds of businesses aren't prepared for an emergency, and 40% of businesses that experience a disaster never recover. Make an emergency plan now before it's too late. For a free online tool that helps you develop an emergency plan to keep your business up and running should disaster strike, visit ready.gov/business. Brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the American Red Cross, and the Ad Council.
We are back once again on this Thanksgiving edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. Hope you're enjoying your holiday. We're enjoying kicking back, having put this one to bed a couple of days early.
Even though we're doing two shows at once, I know we don't have to do another show, except there are lots of stuff coming up in the following weeks, subsequent weeks. Got lots of stuff going on.
So who are we going to hear from next to wrap up this week's edition?
We are going to hear from Drew Goldalian. He is in Wissahickon, Pennsylvania, and he owns Wissahickon Cycles and is the proprietor of Engine Cycles. Drew, thanks for joining us on the show this evening.
How are you doing?
I'm great. It's always fun to talk with frame builders and shop owners, so I get a twofer this evening. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. How is everything going in, it's Wissahickon?
Wissahickon, yeah.
Wissahickon, what a great name. Only in Pennsylvania would you come up with something like that.
Yeah, it's the name of the park that is about a mile down the street from where we're located, and it's more or less the focal point of the mountain bike scene and you know, all things outdoors in the Philadelphia area. And it's a sub-part of the Fairmount Park. Fairmount Park covers everything that's in Philadelphia County, and then the Wissahickon Valley is what's down the street from us, and it's quite popular. It's a nice network of single track. It has a gravel road that goes down the center of it. It has pretty much everything, bird watchers, dog walkers, horseback, bicycles, running.
Cool. So are you originally from the Philadelphia area, from there?
I am not. My mom is from the Philadelphia area. Actually spent the latter half of her youth in the building that the bike shop is in.
Uh-huh.
And I grew up in Princeton, New Jersey.
Uh-huh. That's why you don't have that Philadelphia accent.
Yeah, no, maybe the water. That's about it.
Yeah. I think you're actually the first frame builder shop owner I've spoken with and who also thought his life would be a chef owning a restaurant.
I didn't want to own a restaurant.
Okay.
I just wanted to be a cook. It was all I knew. But I knew I couldn't own a restaurant. That part of the equation was it requires massive manpower, and you know, you have to trust your staff beyond belief, and I kind of knew I was not destined to be that person, but I also knew I couldn't work for anybody anymore. I grew up in an environment where both my parents were self-employed, and I never, ever, ever encountered that conversation or witnessed a conversation of somebody complaining about their job. So,
interesting. Yeah.
The moment I was in a situation where I was kind of down about my job and felt like I was not appreciated, I come home and I just had a conversation. I was like months out of college. I was back at the residence of my parents, and I came home one day and I said, man, my boss is, he's awful. And my dad looked at me and he said, well, quit. So I did.
But you did go to culinary school.
Yeah, I went to restaurant management and so it was a two-part. I have a business degree and an applied science technology degree in culinary arts.
So do you still cook?
I do.
Yeah.
a little more pedestrian than, you know, what I would probably like to do, but I'm also much more of a team effort. My wife is, she cooks far more than I do, and I'm just a little faster, so I can come in and finish it off and or cut things faster, and you know, I do the grill master kind of thing, but all in all, she does more of the cooking, I have to admit.
So I guess we should talk about bicycles and stuff, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. What interested...
Although I love food.
Yeah. I think we all love food. We're bicycle people. Don't we ride to eat? Isn't that what the saying does? Yeah, something like that.
It does make eating better.
Yes, it does. So what I found, of course, very interesting about you and your work is the combination of retail and manufacturing, and yet you keep them totally separate. I heard your presentation at one of the NABS shows, and I was fascinated by how you run your two businesses. So I'd like you to tell us a little bit about your retail store and about how Engine Cycles came about.
Yeah, I mean, from a retail standpoint, it's my priority is to have a shop that supports the local people and, you know, is something there for the community. And selling high-end bicycles is not supporting, you know, 90% of the people that are within driving distance of the business.
Okay.
So, you know, I don't want to intimidate people. I don't want them to feel like they're going to come in and the prices are going to be high because of the fact that what I do is tailor-made bicycles. And all. So it was pretty clear to me in the beginning that I didn't want to put it out there that I'm trying to create a business that's different than what it needs to be in order to stay open. Which is, you know, you need to sell hybrids. You need to service bicycles that cost $100 brand new. You know, you need to do whatever the economy is really asking you to do if you want to stay in business. So for us, that's commuter bikes and, again, hybrids and comfort bikes and mountain bikes as well. I mean, don't get me wrong, we love our mountain bikes and we also like to ride road bikes and we are a full-service bike shop, but, you know, right now the selling thing is commuter bikes and hybrids. So that's what we sell. And you know, I'd say probably like 10% of the people that walk through the door, maybe a little bit more, know what's going on. And, you know, they look up and they see a couple of frames that came back from paint and they know that I made them and they're going to get assembled and be gone by the next time they come in. And, you know, it's... intriguing to them, but most of the people that walk through the door have no idea that there's a facility in the back that makes these bicycles, and brutally honestly, nor do they care. So I'm not offended by it, and you know, I don't want them to be intimidated by it.
So let's talk a little bit about Engine, which is the retail store is called Wiss Cycles.
Yeah, Wissahickon Cyclery is the bike shop, and then Engine Cycles is the brand of bicycles that I make.
And so let's talk a little bit about Engine Cycles. And when did you start building frames?
And 2005.
Okay.
When I more or less created that brand. So in 1995, I opened the bike shop. And the building or the facility that the bike shop is in has about 1,500 square feet of retail on the front. And then it has essentially a 7,000 square foot warehouse located right behind it. And it's separated by just like a little walkway. It's actually connected underground by a tunnel. And in that facility is where all the storage for all the repair bikes takes place and where I have now about 3,000 square feet set up as a shop.
Let's talk a little bit about the kinds of frames you're building. Do you specialize in something? Is Engine specifically known for a specific type of frame?
I don't. I didn't want to get pigeonholed into a category, but I sell more mountain bikes than anything else. So,
okay.
You know, the mountain bike is the bulk of it, and I just prefer to sell bicycles that I fully comprehend and understand and have no hesitation with, and that would be mountain bikes, cyclocross bikes, road bikes of any sort, whether it be, you know, the all-day bike, the going on dirt roads bike, the race bike. I don't see why anybody would want to have a tailor-made race bike. They need and should be disposable. But, you know, anything within those three categories, a light touring bike, meaning like a credit card touring bike,
yep,
where someone would put 20, 25 pounds of stuff on the bike and throw the credit card in their back pocket and ride to the next motel.
Right.
So anything that's going to be in that category of bikes, that's what I like to do. Shouldn't call me to have a track bike, you know, don't call me to make a full-on randonneur bike or just something that I'm out of my element. I don't want to do that. I have very specific ways that I like to do things, and I've spent timeless hours coming up with my ways of doing things relevant to the bikes that I build, and I don't do, like, prototype work. I don't do one-offs. I don't do someone calls me up and has an idea. I don't make that bike.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Drew Goldalian out in Wissahickon, Pennsylvania. He is the owner of a bike shop, Wissahickon Cycles, and Engine Cycles, which is his custom shop. And that's what we're talking about right now. If I were to say, okay, I want to go on a credit card tour this year and next year and for years to come, what kind of materials are you going to offer me? What are you building with right now, Drew?
Steel and titanium.
Okay.
The Chromoly is from a price standpoint far more manageable for most people. It's a wonderful material. It has very few downfalls, and it has a ride quality that obviously is the benchmark for everybody. And then titanium is just a little lighter. It's a little more dent resistant. It doesn't need paint, although you can paint it. And it's got a price tag. So, you know, I don't expect everybody to opt or be interested in the titanium. And when I introduced it, which was very shortly ago, it was not in anticipation of, like, you know, taking over. I figured that steel would still be the go-to material just because, again, from a price point, it's more manageable for a lot of people. But I would probably lean towards steel. The biggest factor for the bike relevant to that scenario is going to be the fork. So there are very few, if any, carbon forks on the market that fit that category. So it's going to, you know, it's going to be a fork that I made out of steel, regardless of the frame. So some people would not want a titanium bike with a steel fork.
And some people might.
Yeah. But the fork is definitely the holdup when it comes to that type of bike. You know, you want fenders. You want to have a certain type of brake that's going to allow for the fender and the slightly larger tire. You're going to have potentially a front rack. All those things essentially don't play friendly with a carbon fork.
That's true. That is all true. Are you building full bikes or are you just shipping frames and forks?
I like to sell complete bikes.
Okay. I know you build your own wheels.
Yeah. This day and age, there's so many tolerance issues when it comes to chain rings and cranks, especially with the mountain bikes and rotor sizes and all these other things, that it's just a little frustrating if you pack something up in a box and send it away and just kind of hope for the best.
Yeah.
And it you know, it's an unrideable object as well, and that upsets me. I mean, I like to make bicycles. I don't making a frame, it doesn't do anything. It wants to become a bicycle, and not being the person that makes it become a bicycle is kind of a bummer. So a little bit of it is the control freak in me, but a little bit of it is, I am a bicycle manufacturer, not a frame builder. I never, ever refer to myself as a frame builder.
Interesting. How many bicycles are you manufacturing a year, approximately? Just a throw a number out there.
I'm not overly prolific. 35.
That's a nice number. I mean, you know, you're looking at close to three a month. And I know what goes into building them. That's a nice number.
Yeah, and I'd love it if all of them were complete. They're not, but
yeah.
That's what essentially lowers that number. I mean, if you took all the wheels and all the stems and C-posts that I make and everything else out of the equation, working the exact same amount of hours that I do right now, I could probably do 50 frames, but I would be less happy because I would send 50 items out that I didn't get to see completion on, and I would make less money. So it's very difficult to, in my opinion, to make a living just making frames. You have to be very prolific and very diligent about just cranking them out. And that's not what I'm interested in. I like making stuff, and I like to do it at a, you know, a quick pace, but not like a crazy pace.
I got it. So are you going to go to NABS this coming year?
Yeah, last year was the first year I took off. We renovated a house, which I knew was going to consume me. So
yeah,
I didn't
no
sign
kidding.
Up. And it was a good move. I would have gone berserk if I tried to do it. So, yeah, going back to Denver, pretty excited about it.
Good.
Got some cool stuff on the horizon.
If people wanted to learn about your bikes, your engine cycles, what's the website?
The website is enginecycles.com.
You want to spell it? Because it's not spelled the way it sounds.
Yeah, it's not. There's no E on the end. So it's enginecycles.com. Okay. And then, linked from that, I have a blog that's on the actual website, and then I have that migrates the same input to Facebook, and then I have my Flickr site, which I'm pretty active on the Flickr site. I mostly do that for my customer base, which likes to see the bike get made, and it's something that a lot of people at first don't think they're going to care about, and then I continually would get emails from people that like, oh, I just didn't think I would care about seeing it get made, but that was so cool, I can't wait to ride it.
Exactly. Keep that anticipation going.
Yeah, I mean, the most difficult thing is the fact that they witnessed it get made, and then it might be 3 months or more before they get it, because
right. It
goes and sits at the paint shop.
Well, I am glad we got a chance to talk. You and I met up at the Philadelphia Bike Show, and we will talk again when I go out to Denver and take a look around NABS this year. So have a great holiday.
Cool.
And
thank you too.
I'll see you in February.
I'm bringing
February.
A huge tandem to Denver. So
oh, are you?
I'd like to see that, yes.
Oh, I'll be anxious to see that. I ride a tandem. I like that. Okay, very good.
All right.
All right. Well, I'll see you in a couple months.
Great. Thank you.
All right, Drew.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Drew Guldalian joined us from Wissahickon, Pennsylvania.
Engine cycles. Interesting perspective on frame building. He gave a really interesting talk at NABS. I'm glad we got to actually talk to him a little more.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this long holiday weekend. Hopefully you'll sneak a little ride in here amongst the family get-togethers and the feasting.
Yeah, like ride those calories off.
All right.
On that note,
we'll be back live and in person next week with another edition of The Outspoken Cyclist.
We will indeed.
All right. Until then, take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.